Welcome to Independent Curriculum, the podcast. Independent Curriculum highlights the ideas, organizations, schools, and individuals playing important roles in shaping the future of education. I'm Peter Gao, Executive Director of the Independent Curriculum Group, a global consortium of over 140 schools interested in building stronger, more effective academic programs that meet the needs of their own students in alignment with each school's unique mission and values. You can learn more about us by visiting our website at independentcurriculum.org. For this, our inaugural episode, we focus on an organization, the Edward E. Ford Foundation, known for funding new initiatives in independent schools. My guest today is John Gulla, the executive director of the E.E. Ford Foundation and a former teacher and school head. In his current role, John is an important voice in all conversations about the future of education. And I want to say that this will be part one of a two-part podcast. We hope that you will return for part two, available today, and for all our future independent curriculum podcasts. John, thank you for being with us and for the work you do and have done in education.
My great pleasure, Peter, to be with you.
Well, for some questions, I'd like to start with some basics. What is the E.E. Ford Foundation, and what's the mission?
The Edward E. Ford Foundation serves independent schools throughout the U.S. In the late 1950s, Edward E. Ford, an alumnus of Mercersburg Academy, made an initial gift that began the foundation. He was motivated by his experience at Mercersburg Academy to contribute back both to his alma mater, but more broadly to independent schools. He believed in the mission of independent schools. Our mission as a foundation is, and I quote, to strengthen and support independent secondary schools and to challenge and inspire them to leverage their unique talents, expertise, and resources, and to advance teaching and learning throughout the country by supporting and disseminating best practices, by supporting efforts to develop and implement models of sustainability, and by encouraging collaboration with other institutions, end quote. So that's a quick thumbnail sketch of what the E. Ford Foundation is all about and how it came to be.
Can you speak to how the E. Ford Foundation has evolved in its outlook on schools and education and sort of the imperatives of the era, either from its beginnings or just in your own time as executive director?
That the E. Ford Foundation has made well over 2,000 grants valued at over $110 million to over 800 different independent schools throughout the country, and we only work with U.S.-based domestic schools. At a point several decades ago, the foundation began to require schools to raise matching funds at a ratio of at least $1 of additional funds raised by the school or the organization for every dollar from the foundation. And so over $100 million in additional funding has been raised by independent schools in matching funds. And before I dig into that, maybe I'll just take a minute or two to describe historically the grant-making cycles of the foundation. So for most of the 60-year period, the foundation's history had eligible schools. And by eligible schools, the following are the sort of general criteria for eligibility. Schools need to be members of the National Association of Independent Schools. A school head must be in place for at least 2 full years at the point in which the proposal from the school will be considered by the board. The school must graduate students, that is to say, it must have an upper school. It can be just 9 through 12 or 6 to 12 or K to 12, but the terms of the foundation as the trust established it do not allow K to 6 or K to 8 schools to come to us. Schools to be eligible to come to E. Ford must also be committed to serve a diverse population. And then finally, if a school has received earlier grants from us, they must have shown themselves to have been good stewards of our past philanthropy. So schools that meet those criteria can come to the foundation, essentially come knock on our door and ask to be placed on a future agenda. That's our terminology for one of the three meetings that the board conducts each year. And they can bring a proposal to us at one of those meetings once placed on an agenda. So as I said earlier in the beginning, the grants did not have firm caps. In fact, at the very beginning, many of the grants that we made were for endowments. At some point during the foundation's history, we stopped allowing our money to be used for endowments, although the matching funds can be used for a permanently restricted endowment. There's something deep in the DNA of the E. Ford Foundation that recognizes, in terms of the historical practice and our current practice, that we believe, Edward E. Ford believed, that independent schools knew best how we might best be able to help them. Put another way, is unlike some foundations, we really aren't trying to concentrate on certain areas of independent school work. We turn to schools, and we believe that schools know what they might most need, what we might best be able to help them accomplish, how our help might be leveraged in some particularly effective way for them. But we do not, in terms of the regular grant cycles, express a particular orientation toward any particular area of independent school work. We have funded proposals for program expansion, for professional development for faculty, for capital projects, certainly for curriculum development, for financial aid, for equipment. And there have been a number of, and perhaps in many ways some of the most exciting work or experiments that are conducted. Schools that have an idea come to us with what might be seen as venture capital requests, something that they'd like to try. Not all of those experiments are successful, but some are, and some have been adopted and widely promulgated throughout the independent school world. So in what had historically been the three agendas, April, June, and November, schools would come to the foundation, seek placement on one of those agendas. And let me describe briefly the general process that we follow today, even for those the two June and November agendas for traditional grants. A school begins the process with the school head calling the foundation, and the school head and I will have a discussion. I want to be sure that the school head understands the process, that I learn enough about the school to, A, make sure it's eligible to bring a proposal to us, and B, if I see any red flags in that preliminary conversation that might raise concerns eventually at the board level, I want to be sure to point those out to the school head. Not that those red flags would disqualify a school from pursuing a proposal with us, but I think full disclosure is important, and I would want the school to know that it might be a bit of a long shot. Example, that a school that had been operating for several years with an operating deficit in its budget, or a school whose board does not support its own annual fund, or some other things that might be red flags for the Ford board, I want to point those out. And then C, I want to be sure that the school head really understands, if they come to us with a proposal, what will be involved. And ours is a fairly detailed analysis of a school, and there's a fair amount of work that goes into it. Once a school is placed on the agenda, which, as I say, can only happen after I've had a conversation with the school head over the telephone, the next step is for the school head to come to meet with me and the foundation office here in Brooklyn, New York. That meeting can take place at any point after a school has been placed on a future agenda, but no later than 2 months before the proposal will be considered by the board. Once that meeting gets set, then the school needs to fill out an online application that provides us here at the foundation with a considerable amount of quantitative data concerning the school's operation. Then the face-to-face meeting that takes place with me as executive director and the school head, usually 2-2.5 hours, covers the school's history, our current operation, some of the challenges, some of the strengths, some of the plans for the future. And that conversation will almost always include some discussion about the specifics of the proposal that the school head intends to make to the foundation. The historical average, quote, success, unquote, rate for proposals has varied, but recently it's been in about the 70% range. About 70% of the schools that complete the process have their proposals funded. But about a decade ago, the board decided, in an effort to stay relevant to the full range of NAIS schools, and given, as I mentioned earlier, that the change in the average grant to average tuition ratio, the E. Ford Foundation Advisory Board decided to take the April agenda and create what it now calls a leadership grant cycle that would award a smaller number of grants at a larger dollar figure. So for the last 9 years, E.E. Ford has awarded an average of 4 separate $250,000 grants each April to schools. Again, those grants need to be matched at least one-to-one. So most of those proposals have been $500,000 proposals. But some schools have had more ambitious matches that have come to us with 1-to-2, 1-to-3, 1-to-4 matches. And there have been a number of $1 million-plus proposals that have been funded through that leadership grant. There are expectations for the leadership grants that are elevated, that there is even more of an expectation on the part of the foundation that those grants will catalyze change or incubate new ways of thinking about some aspect of independent school work, some of the challenges that we face. There's a belief on the part of the foundation board that we hope those leadership grants will be like pebbles in the pond of independent education, that they'll have positive ripples that will spread throughout our independent school world. We favor grants for the leadership agendas that we believe could be replicable, that we think would benefit schools more broadly than the school itself. For the last 9 years, those leadership grants have been by invitation only. The foundation board each year, in advance of each April meeting, would focus on a framing question, and here it differed from its historical practice and actually focused on some area of independent school work, and then asked the executive director to generate a pool of schools interested in submitting proposals that would address some element of that framing question. But one of the fortuitous aspects of your invitation to me to speak right now is that there's some late breaking news. And in June, the board decided that it was going to change the way in which it handled the leadership grants. But that it'll be possible for schools to approach the foundation and get in the queue for leadership grants. So to summarize all that, and I know that's long, June and November will continue to be traditional grants, but even there, in this recent June meeting, we made some changes. Previously, the ceiling for those proposals for those June and November grants had been $50,000. Starting with June 2017, those traditional grants for June and November, we will entertain proposals for grants between $25,000 and $100,000, again, matched one-to-one. So we've actually now specified a range, $25,000 to $100,000, and raised that cap from $50,000 to $100,000. Now, as if that weren't a whole confusing and an awful lot to put forth, The board decided as an experiment for April of 2017, we are going to make a single $2 million grant to a collaboration of schools, what we're calling the Collaborative Innovation Grant. Again, that needs to be matched at least one-to-one, so there'll be a single project which will involve a collaboration of schools. A group of schools will come to us. We're already in the finalist stage of considering those for a single $2 million grant, again, for a $4 million project. But then, beginning April of 18, we will revert back to the leadership grants.
It sounds like that the leadership grants are really intended to change the role of independent schools vis-a-vis one another and maybe vis-a-vis education as a whole, to engage schools with larger questions that are not just worrying about what's going on within their own walls. Is that a change for the E.E. Ford Foundation or an evolution?
I think the leadership grant program, from its inception 9 years ago, always was looking more broadly at the whole world of independent schools, hoping that we could use our philanthropy through the leadership grant program to give schools a chance to try something that they might not otherwise be willing to try, where it may have been difficult for a school to have made the case to use some of their precious internal resources to try something that wasn't sure to work, that might be experimental, that might be a little bit untraditional. But very much with the idea that a school would, as a result of its experience with a leadership grant, promulgate its findings. If it was a successful experiment, to talk with its regional association at the national meeting, to write about it, to blog about it, to spread the good word, and to figure out ways where other schools might learn from and benefit from their experiment. Some of the traditional grants have been of that sort as well, but many of the traditional grants were focused more within the community of a single independent school itself, didn't always have potential ripple effects, implications for others. But the framing questions, each of those 9 years when the foundation did identify some area of work, it was often with an eye toward influencing practice within the independent school world. So let me just give you some example. There were, when it was in the sort of zeitgeist of the independent school world, when NAS and many independent school leaders were focusing on the public purpose of private schools, that or a variation was a focus of the framing question for a couple of different years. You might remember, some listeners to this may remember, the Innovation Summit at Hathaway Brown that was supported by an E. Ford leadership grant in 2008. Punahou had done some very impressive work in forging global connections internationally connected with youth leadership, and that had been supported with the leadership grant. Winchester Thurston, and I'll name just that school, although I could name a half a dozen, that have looked at their location. Winchester Thurston had a wildly successful City as Campus project that's grown steadily and become an increasingly important part of that school and that community since we helped them launch that. And parenthetically, I should add, one of the pathways that sometimes has been seen at E.E. Ford as being effective is that a school, and Winchester Thurston was an example of this, first came to us for a traditional grant, for a $50,000 grant. And those were the smallest seeds of their City as Campus project, which took root, were seen by the community, by Winchester Thurston, as being important and successful, and then grew. They came back to us with a proposal for a leadership grant. We're invited to come back that helped them scale that same basic idea. I should also mention, because it may not be clear given what I said earlier, that in addition to schools, the foundation also has long supported state, regional, and national associations of independent schools.
And we should also probably mention that all of the at least recent grants made by the E.E. Ford Foundation are, I think, findable online at the E.E. Ford Foundation website. Is that correct?
That is correct. At www.eeford.org. One of the things that I'm loving about the work itself is that we operate too often in isolation. That they're really good, important people doing great work at their school, but they don't always know that across the state or across the country somebody else is undertaking a quite similar project. And so I have this rare opportunity to do some matchmaking. I talked about Hawken and Lovett and the Seattle Academy of Arts and Sciences. It turned out that in one given cycle, all three of those schools were pursuing projects that were notably similar. And I had the chance to put in touch with each other, Laura Deisley, who was the sort of key person at Lovett, Doris Corder at Hawken, and Lisa Feiertag at Seattle Academy of Arts and Sciences, who ended up collaborating with each other. I think they made a joint presentation at the NAS meeting back in Boston a year and a half or so ago. So it's one of the unexpected pleasures of me being able to point out to schools some resources they may find among their colleagues, because they just didn't happen to know that a school in California was doing something quite similar to a school in Maryland.
Well, that sounds like a really exciting job, and much like the job that I have, only you're on a perhaps even larger scale, and that's fantastic. And on the subject of you, I'd like to just sort of switch gears a little bit and talk about you. And how did you wind up at the Edward E. Ford Foundation, and sort of what was your journey to that spot?
Sure. Well, thank you for asking. I grew up in Walpole, Massachusetts. As the son of two public school teachers. My mom taught fifth grade in Walpole Public Schools, and my dad actually started out as a shopkeeper in Massachusetts. It used to be called package stores, but he then went back to school and earned a degree and then became a teacher and then later a principal and briefly a superintendent. But this was an Italian-Irish family of many aunts and uncles, and every single aunt and uncle, and I mean without exception, every one of my aunts and uncles in this large family were involved in public school education in the Walpole-Norwood area. And I had no intention of joining the family profession. I went to Walpole High School, involved in athletics, and we had a very competitive athletic program, but was fortunate enough to be admitted to Amherst College, where I fell in love with learning. I had wonderful teachers and pushed myself and had a whole the world open up to me as a result. I liked it enough that I stayed for an extra year in a position that Amherst affectionately called the Green Dean, where I traveled around as representatives of colleges do to high schools all over the country, talking to them about potential admission to Amherst, and decided that I liked this world, this family line of work, and wanted to teach, had no patience or interest in getting certified, so it was the independent school world that would take me without certification. One of those visits during my Green Dean year had been to, I actually had a couple visits to New York and then was fortunate enough to have made a number of connections in the New York independent school world, but it was a place, St. Anne's in Brooklyn Heights, that had caught my interest, and I applied and was hired to teach math and physics at St. Anne's, which I did for several years, and then became middle school director at St. Anne's at the ripe old age of 26. There was a visionary iconoclastic headmaster, Stanley Bosworth, who was willing to appoint this 26-year-old as middle school director of St. Anne's. I was there. I met my wife, who had been teaching and working at St. Anne's. She's the one who had an independent school experience. She went to Little Red Elizabeth Irwin here in New York. While I was at St. Anne's, I got a master's at Teachers College at Knightson in the summer, and was fortunate enough to have had the legendary Maxine Green as my advisor. I wanted to stretch myself and try some new challenges. I did not want to stay just as a middle school administrator, so applied to be an upper school director and was hired at Isadora Newman by a man named Mike Lacopo, who had offered me a job at Horace Mann when I was first coming to New York. So I went to New Orleans. Andrea and I had married, and we went to Be Easy, and was at Newman with Mike and a fellow by the name of Robert Blair as upper school director. First child was born there, but when that first child arrived, we realized we wanted to be back closer to family. And so I pursued a position at Riverdale Country School, initially as upper school director, in a role I served for 2 years, and then was appointed as associated headmaster, where I stayed for an extra 7 years in that role, and learned an awful lot. By the end of that period, 9 years in total at Riverdale, I felt I was ready to try my hand, and then went into the search. Was fortunate enough to have a couple of different offers in that one season where I went looking. And the one that seemed to make the most sense to me was the Blake School in Minneapolis. So I said yes to them, and we as Twain said, lit out for the territories. My wife and, by this point, two sons and I, we were where we were for 14 years and had a terrific time. But the upper Midwest was never going to be permanent home, and for a number of reasons, aging parents and a desire to be back where we knew we would really want to stay longer term, we returned to New York. And I looked at some school opportunities, but at the time in which we were coming back, the E. Ford Foundation executive director role was open, and consultant Earl Ball was serving as a consultant, had contacted me and asked if I would be interested. I knew that we were coming back to be in New York specifically, to be near my mother-in-law, who is here. And I wasn't aware that E. Ford was a movable feast, that the office had been in Portland, Maine, but I didn't look at it as an opportunity because I knew it wasn't going to be in Portland. But Earl told me that the foundation was fine with the office being wherever the executive director wanted it to be. And so I pursued it, liked what I learned, and the board thought I would be able to follow in the footsteps of some really fine people who have been the executive director, Bob Hallett, Walter Bergen, Phil Havens, and reverse chronological, or at least the three. So I said yes, and this is now my fourth year at E.E. Ford.
So, John, what have been the big influences, and who have been the big influences on you as an educator, the people, the experiences, the ideas that have made a difference in your life as an educator?
Certainly the school heads of the schools where I worked before becoming a head. Stanley Bosworth at St. Anne's, Mike Lacopo at Isidore Newman, Roger Bucock at Riverdale Country School. But my Walpole High, my high school football coach, taught me to be tough and to persevere and not to quit. I had two unbelievable advisors at Amherst College, Norton Starr in mathematics and Dudley Town in physics, who helped me develop an appreciation for the life of the mind. Ed Wall, who was my first boss, who was a legendary dean of admission at Amherst, provided me with the inspiration to see education as a profoundly influential means for making a life of your own choosing. I mentioned my advisor at Teachers College was Maxine Green. Maxine and another teacher, Phil Phoenix, were incredible influences, but Maxine may have been the best read person I've ever had the good fortune to come to know, and I would sit in her office at Teachers College with other students, and she would chain smoke and hold forth on Hawthorne and Emerson and Melville and de Beauvoir, and it was Maxine who helped me appreciate what she really meant when she said that to be educated was to be able to see things as if they could be otherwise. There have been other people, certainly independent school colleagues. I mentioned Robert Blair, but people like Dan Miller and Amy Richards and Mike Michelson and Lisa Lyle and Rand Harrington, Joe Seibold, people I've had the good fortune to work with. But of course, for anybody, it's one's my two teacher parents, my siblings, my wife of 29 years, Andrea Goodbow, who taught me more than anyone about everything, and our two sons, Benjamin, who teaches at a progressive independent school in Cape Town, South Africa, and Zachary, who lives in Santa Monica and works in the production side of TV and film industry, but all have contributed, and I'm grateful to have been blessed with so many wonderful family members and good friends.
Well, that's fantastic, and certainly in sort of the independent school experience, you've worked with some of the giants, I think. And you've talked a little bit about your role in the decision-making process, that the process begins by a school contacting you. And I'm just sort of wondering, on a maybe lighter side, that I assume then that you are the subject of all kinds of supplication and propitiation, and sort of wondering, perhaps especially after running a school, whether it feels strange to have, I'm just assuming that everybody is always nice to you, is that right? How is that?
It's true that I think there is an awareness on the part of the schools that are initiating proposals to their foundation that it doesn't serve them well to be rude to the executive director or to fail to return his phone calls or attend to questions sent via email, etc. It can be quite a bit different than life as a school head. But I'm fortunate enough to have family and friends who keep my ego in check. And the E.E. Ford office is me and my incredibly able assistant, Lucy Kaminsky. That's the two of us. I have a board with whom we work closely, and that they're quite committed to the foundation, but that's a big change, professional change. It's been 4 years. I haven't had a single angry or over-entitled parent come barging into my office to make some unreasonable demand about how their daughter deserved to play number one singles in tennis or why Junior didn't get into Stanford. And that I don't miss. But the work at the foundation is just of a different sort. I'm reading much, much more than I ever had time to read as a school head. I mean, just within the last week, Todd Rose's The End of Average and Harari's Sapiens. I mean, that would have been 2 months worth of reading as a school head, and this was a week's worth of reading at the E. Ford Foundation. I mean, I follow a dozen professional journals and blogs, and I read and write and speak on topics which I've actually researched and been paying attention to what's going on in the profession and the larger world of independent schools in a way it's just not possible for a school head. And so the way I've described it is that I feel I'm exercising very different muscles now, muscles that are more related to general independent school issues and not to a specific school. So for 35 years, I didn't often pick up my gaze beyond just the tips of my shoes when I was at St. Anne's or Newman or Riverdale or Blake. But now I visit 80 or more schools a year all around the country. I've visited over 250 schools in the time I've been executive director in 47 of the 50 states. And I end up in those meetings that I described earlier, talking with school heads. But also because of the nature of the foundation's work, I talk with other independent school leaders and teachers and administrators and others interested in the world of education more generally. And not just from the narrow part of the NAS spectrum where one can find the types of the four pre-K to 12 highly selective, financially secure, academically ambitious schools that had employed me. But I have come to know day schools, boarding day schools, day boarding schools, single-sex schools, military schools, schools with strong religious traditions, schools with weak religious traditions and no religious traditions. I've come to know and work with independent schools serving students with pronounced learning differences, schools that admit essentially all who show up, other schools that admit fewer than 1 in 10, or in some cases 1 in 20 of those who apply. I've worked and come to know schools that charge less than $12,000 a year for tuition, and some that are well over 50. In fact, some are over $75,000 a year for tuition. I've come to know and work with schools that have an endowment net of debt over $1 million per student, and some schools that have no endowment have in fact, negative assets. I've worked with schools that don't charge any tuition that are members of the NAS network. So I have a much fuller, broader sense of the diversity of independent schools and the mission of those of independent schools of the 1,580 or so NAS schools than I ever had when I worked in a single school.
When you have this amazing perspective, and I have to say I kind of envy your ability to just kind of see and encompass all of these different kinds of schools and different kinds of educational offerings that they are providing, are there big questions that you see schools, questions in common that schools have? And, you know, maybe are there interesting outlier questions that when you hear a school ask it, you think, why isn't everyone asking that? Or that's worth pursuing?
Yeah, that's a great question, one that occupies an awful lot of my thinking. I mean, pattern recognition is something that's always been just a part of my intellectual engagement with the world. But the overlay is that I think in the world of education, I think we often hunt for general solutions. We're looking for something that will work for all. And increasingly, I see schools, the most successful schools, are those that recognize that they draw on practices and traditions that work for them in their community, given their mission. That's not to say I don't see patterns. I do, and I'll talk about those in just a second. But one of the things that comes to mind when you ask the question is my recognition that if I were to distill my 3.5 decades of working in independent schools, and now 3+ years at the Ford Foundation into a single pithy bit of wisdom. It's that education is just not a one-size-fits-all enterprise, and that I am delighted, proud, and hopeful that the world of independent schools has the ability to reinvent itself, to try new things, to chart new paths. Certainly, the foundation sees, and I don't mean by talking about the patterns of the frequency of certain proposals to suggest to anyone listening to this that they shouldn't pursue this if that's what interests them. But we are up to our ears in STEM and STEAM and makerspace and design thinking and fabrication labs and innovation labs and tinker tables and learning commons. Please don't call them libraries. But we see an awful lot of project-based learning proposals. There's this wide and shared interest in many areas of the country in different types of independent schools and entrepreneurialism, in student agency, in the role of student-directed learning, of harnessing the interest of students to deepen their engagement. Certainly, there's a pattern of specialized efforts in global studies, and to my great delight, deepening and broadening commitments on the part of many, many independent schools to their community, to service learning, and the way in which what you and I, Peter, both remember was at one point community service and evolved to be service learning, and the way in which it's integrated into the curriculum and to the work of a school. But schools with proposals and foci on leadership training, and those that are utilizing transcript notation or graduation distinction for those with global competency or with certain commitments to service. Separately, I see really exciting work that interests me and that I think will accelerate in the years to come with virtual reality. With some of the tools like HoloLens or ZSpace or even the Google Cardboard. And then technology more generally, especially technology and the way in which schools, and I think independent schools are really to be commended for wrestling, not all, but many in a good faith way with the implications for the digital natives, for these kids whose social lives are so wired, who text and sext and who are tethered to their smartphones, and all that we're going to need to think about as this particular technology just continues to inform so much of our lives. There are other sort of technology patterns that I see, sort of online classes and in schools that are thinking and wrestling with those. How might they, whether it's blended learning or strictly online class, and some of the leaders of Global Online Academy, the online school for girls, the whole notion that NAS piloted about sustainability, and not just environmental, that's central, but also financial sustainability, cultural sustainability. Given where we are at this particular moment, time schools that are wrestling with issues of social justice and equity, pluralism, racial, religious, socioeconomic diversity, sexual orientation, gender identity, the number of schools where transgender issues, I'd probably hear from a school every other week or so that's wrestling with that question. There are the, unrelated to any of that, but the separate phenomena of badging, of credentialing, of unbundling, notions of competency measurement, what are generally called, although I don't like the term, wish there was a better term, but non-cognitive skills, and the emphasis I think that independent schools, many independent schools, are placing on non-cognitive skills, and the measurement of those, of student progress there. Certainly all the ways in which we as educators have benefited from advances in neuroscience and what we now know about how we learn that we just didn't before. But there are other phenomena that I see, the number of things that are happening in different states, the competition for from for-profit schools the notion of tax credits in states that are giving tax credits, not deductions, but credits, as a way of channeling public money and all that goes along with that. But if I were to sort of summarize some of that, one of the things that is the model that I have in my mind is, as I try to learn about a school, come to know a school, is learning about its culture. Somebody along the way, and I'm sure this is sort of an oft-repeated phrase, but somebody mentioned it to me and it stuck with me because I see it, that culture eats strategy for lunch. That is to say, with schools spend an awful lot of time thinking about their strategic plan, but what really matters in schools is the culture that they create. So that is sort of maybe a long-winded way of trying to get around to the answer to your good question.
This ends part one of the Independent Curriculum Group's interview with John Gulla of the E.E. Ford Foundation. In part two, available here on iTunes, John and I will pursue more questions about the role of independent schools and about what kinds of things the foundation seeks in successful proposals. This is Peter Gao, thanking you for listening today and looking forward to having you with us in the future.